Hey everybody, welcome to V Speaks Conversations with Heart and Soul. I'm your host, Lisa Burwell, and I'm thrilled to be in Sowall House, one of the coolest places, no, the coolest place you can have an interview. It's Dave King's creation, curation, and this man is a fascinating gentleman who I've known for 5 years now. And I want to welcome him to the podcast. Welcome to the podcast, Dave.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm so glad. Well, we did a podcast before at our office a couple years ago.
That's right, yeah.
And I was...
Time flies. Yeah.
I think it was just 2 years ago, maybe 2.5 years ago, though. And there were so many things happening then that, like, I'll just touch on for a second. But since that time, you have skyrocketed into many different creative directions and seem to have quantum leaped since that podcast. Do you feel
I'm glad it looks like that from the outside. I mean, on the inside, I'm just doing the work that I've been doing along this whole time.
You have.
I think that the difference now is that we're a more recognizable brand. Mm-hmm. We've stated what our beliefs are as a business and, you know, what our philosophy is as a conglomerate of artists that come together a lot. And people believe in it now. You know, they kind of see the proof of it. But it took, you know, probably 3 or 4 years for that flower to sort of blossom.
During the period of time from your inception until you saw the blossoming, which I know is true, that happened. And our town is funny like that. Like, they test the waters. Did you notice that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, rightfully so.
Yeah. And obviously, you started off with this magnificent space that is unlike any other. Like, it's just, like, completely tricked out. It's your home base, which I think was a really smart thing to do because this is all of your brand. You know, it's just like, you know, shouting from the rooftops your excellence and what you intended to do with the space. When we first met for lunch 5 years ago, one of the main initiatives at that moment in time was you jumping into the podcast foray and then all that happened there. Can we just start there, seeing as we're on a podcast?
Yeah,
right now?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, talk about that dream, but you had so many other dreams going on simultaneous that would be this creative hub that like has offshoots like aplenty.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the journey was not a straight line and it still isn't a straight line, but we're exactly where I had, you know, projected that we would be 5 years ago. And so, you know, Sowall House is, we offer podcast services and it's, you know, there's a real creative bend to that, which is why we designed the podcast room the way that it is. We're also a private club. So it's kind of like podcasting during the day, private club at night. We're still very art forward, very local centric. So where our programming is very eclectic and I call them metropolitan experiences. Mm-hmm. That was on the docket day one. And we wanted to get in the film and music space as well. So, I mean, we're if you look at it from 100,000 foot view, you know, we're checking all those boxes. I mean, some of those boxes got checked years after we had put them out. But I think that finally, and it's really fun. It's really exciting to see, you know, what's happening internally with all the stuff that we have going on and the upcoming work that we're doing. It's really great to see the effort that you put into something start moving the needle. Before, it was a tremendous amount of effort and the needle would just barely nudge. And that would be like just enough reward to keep going, you know. Now it's the efforts that we put into things, there's a noticeable movement in that needle of progress.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever a moment during that time where you had second-guessed yourself and wondered, like, should I be doing this?
That's a great question. I think the mission in my mind was, like, so clear and visible that I don't think I ever second-guessed anything. But there's always, and I think there's gonna be probably some times going forward where it's like, are we approaching this the right way? You know, are we being inclusive in the right way, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Are we being exclusive in the right way? And I don't really like the exclusivity business model. I think that we're a much more inclusive business than exclusive, but there's moments of the business that you just have to be, mm-hmm. you know? So I wouldn't call it like second guessing. Is what we're doing the right thing? I think that's always been a yes. It's how we get there. You know, I believe in delayed gratification. And I think that like that is the most potent tool in the arsenal of an entrepreneur.
It is. But from what I know about you, outside looking in, you were so successful in your business in New York that maybe because you were so successful, you also had that confidence that this too would be successful because you had tasted great success. And take the audience back here about what you were doing. And you had told me your goal way back when was to retire when you were 40, but you say, well, I didn't make it. I made 42, but hey, tomatoes, tomatoes.
I'm always late. I don't think
2 years later at 42 is really right. late. So what was the business that you were in, which is very different seemingly to the business you are in now?
Sure. So when I was in New York, I was a technology manager for a hedge fund group. And, but I painted my way through a computer science degree. So if I didn't sell enough paintings that semester, I didn't go to class that semester. So it took me 7 years to get through a 4-year degree. Mm. 'Cause sometimes I could only take like one class a semester and sometimes I wouldn't be able to take any classes a semester. And then other semesters I would double up.
Mm-hmm. How did you sell your art?
I was represented by an art gallery.
Oh, okay. You mm-hmm. were.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. And that, so I sold art to fund college and I bartended to pay rent. So I bartended on like Friday and Saturday nights at this hip little Mexican restaurant. And when I moved to New York, I was like, okay, I've got a computer science degree. I'm an artist and I can bartend. So of those three things, one of them should hit. Mm. And luckily, the computer science thing hit first.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And the rest is kind of history. Yeah.
So you are the true example of right brain, left brain, being able to coexist and actually use it all, right? I mean, that's a gift, don't you think?
I think in terms of risk management, mm-hmm. Rather than like, you know, which side of the brain is it? Okay. Is it the art side or uh-huh. the intellect side that's, you know, doing the, I approach everything through like the lens of risk in like a really healthy way. So some people think in terms of like, what's the next logical step? I'm always thinking like, what's the next logical risk to take mm-hmm. for whatever I'm doing, mm-hmm. you know? So for Sewell House, it was like, this is the next logical risk. Like, let's create this business. Let's put a really long tail on it mm-hmm. and let's give it years to tell us what it really wants to be. And we're just going to give it some guidelines and we'll figure out how along the way, mm-hmm. you know, that's where it's like, you know, club, podcast, mm-hmm. entertainment, video, music, mm. like, let's just do all that stuff.
So many things.
Yeah, and, you know, I have a severe allergy to cubicles and offices. So, I knew that I needed a space to work out of during the day. And I also wanted a place that was kind of hip to host gatherings in the evenings.
And you saw something that was missing in our area that you thought you could actually serve too, right? Because our area needed you, obviously.
Well, I mean, when I moved here, so I've been here now 8 years, I would ask around like where do the artists hang out? Like mm-hmm. where are the cool kids? Like mm-hmm. where are the cool kids hang out, right? Mm-hmm. If you ask that in New York, people will tell you like, oh, well all the painters hang out over here and the film dorks hang out, you know, in the village and you know, so there's an answer to that question. Down here, everyone told me the exact same thing, and it was there isn't really a place that they hang out. Most people work from home. Mm-hmm. So in most cities you have like a third place. Mm-hmm. So you have home, you have work that would be an office, and then you have that third place, and that third place is the community space. So it can be a coffee shop or whatever. This area was kind of missing that third place because there wasn't really a second place. Most people work from home. Mm-hmm. And that was something that I was like, I know that that's what the gap is. So if I can fill that gap for myself, then hopefully other people will find it attractive and want to kind of join me in that quest, mm-hmm. right? Creating the third space. Mm-hmm. And it's taken time, but yeah, I mean, that's absolutely what's happened. The amount of community support that we get is so humbling, and we're so grateful for it because we do some pretty eclectic things, you know, mm-hmm. and we're still just doing some kind of off-kilter, off-the-wall programming. Mm-hmm. From bringing in, you know, superstar stand-up comedians to, you know, hosting live jazz, which we can talk about. I call it the Pepe Le Pew effect. Mm-hmm. To, you know, just bringing people in from all over the country mm-hmm. that are, you know, worldwide entertainers to come into a small room and have this shared experience mm-hmm. together. It's just really amazing. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, cabarets and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Art shows too. You've hosted art shows,
cabarets. We have, Nicole Paloma's runway fashion show. It'll be the first time that we've ever done like a runway before. Mm-hmm. So we're really excited about that. So the space is really designed as like a Swiss Army knife mm-hmm. to every time people come in, there should be something a little bit different, right. You know, yeah, right. As we evolve.
Right. So when you first, were opening, I think you, it seemed like some of our conversations were like, glad to be out of New York. And I said, well, how do you feel here? And like, well, it's very different, you know, so there was some getting used to it. And we fast forward and we'll have to fill in a lot of gaps in the middle of this after we have this conversation. And now fast forward, you're pretty much splitting your time at the moment, like between here and New York. So New York called you back on a couple of things, right?
yeah.
With your building you bought in
apartment
yeah. that you have, mm-hmm. and you know what the use is for that, and then also with all your techie understanding and being really good at that, then you were able to do the walking tour maps for New York, sure. which I would like you to talk about. But then talk about those, but then segue as to New York called you back now, where you're in the Sear studio filming for your new movie.
Yeah.
So like that's a big absolutely. Trajectory, but like fill in the
gaps. There's a lot. So I split my time about 80-20 New York. So I'm here about 80% of the time and about 20% New York. So roughly every 2 months I'm in the city for like a week or two. The reason for that was that like that's where I go to recharge mm-hmm. creatively. Mm-hmm. And again, it turned into if I feel that way, then there's probably other creatives that feel that way as well. Like, you know, I use the city to recharge, not necessarily nature, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Skyscrapers are my trees, you know. Stifling subway heat, that's my oxygen. You know, I love it. So I kind of bought this tiny little shoebox pied-à-terre with a magnificent view of a brick wall, exactly as it should be, mm-hmm. almost like a starving artist loft. Mm-hmm. It has a manual elevator. It's one of only 7 manual elevators in the city. So you have to be a certified elevator driver to go up and down in this elevator. So the building has a mm-hmm. has a certified guy to do that. It's just a really neat, eclectic building. Mm-hmm. So when I'm there, it's like I'm out of the bubble that we have in South Walton. South Walton is an amazing, beautiful bubble, almost to the point that it doesn't feel real sometimes, you know? So it's nice to kind of, for me, it's nice to kind of get out in a big city with, you know, New York City is one of the 5th most dense places on the planet, to experience being a stranger again.
That can feel great.
It feels really great. So That's what I initially intended the apartment to do, is just to kind of be like the Superman's lair, right? But I'm also a workaholic, and I love working and having something to do. So the first summer that I had the apartment, I developed a self-guided walking tour of the East Village to the West Village. I even got, because I was like, it would be inauthentic if I weren't a licensed New York City tour guide. So I took the exam. It's the hardest professional exam I've ever taken in my life. And I became a registered New York City tour guide so that I would, you know, kind of feel like I'm not a phony as I'm doing the self-guided walking tour. So it was really just a great passion of mine to, you know, to do that and to learn all the specifics about these places.
Wow. How long really does amazing. It take from start to finish to do the tour?
It's about an hour and a half.
Okay. It's a good workout.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's about an hour and a half. It's about a 2-mile walk.
That's great.
And you know, you just kind of go through the pop culture of New York City. So Taylor Swift's apartment, Bob Dylan's apartment, the oldest continually ran bar in the city called McSorley's. It's this great little dive bar. So you kind of like go in and out, and you're walking through New York City, you know, 150 years of New York City pop culture. Amazing. So that's a lot of fun. Last summer, I was like, all right, I want to do another walking tour, and I want it to be about jazz, because jazz is, it's got me, you know, it's taken my soul. So there's a street called 52nd Street, between 5th and 6th Avenues. And on 52nd Street, that's where like all the New York City jazz clubs were in the 1940s and into the 1950s. So I was like, so that'll be a great place to start this walking tour. So I'm walking down to do my recon of 52nd Street, and there's zero remnants of it at all whatsoever.
Really?
Yeah, so there's zero remnants of it. It's all parking garages and hotels and bank vestibules. There isn't a plaque. There isn't a sign. You would never know that, like all this special stuff took place here. So I got kind of depressed because I had built up. It takes hours and hours and hours to create a walking tour, and you have to script everything out. So I was like, well, I had that bank of effort that I thought I was going to spend on this, and now I don't have that bank of effort. Like I have nothing to spend that bank of effort for. And I was like, you know, someone should write, because we'll never see it again. We'll never see 52nd Street or experience again, unless someone creates a TV series. And then I was like, what would that look like? It'd probably look like Mad Men instead of ad executives on Madison Avenue. It's jazz guys in the basements on 52nd Street. Like that would be a really cool TV series. Someone should totally do that. And I bet you're the same way. When you think someone should do X, I catch myself and I say, why can't I do it? Like if this is actually a good idea and someone hasn't done it yet, what's stopping me from doing it? So I wrote a TV series. I've never done screenplay writing before, but I wrote a screenplay called Jasmine and released it to a bunch of screenwriting competitions. And the doggone thing is kind of a hit, and it's getting passed around all the circles. And there's a reasonable likelihood that this thing is going to get picked up.
Amazing.
That's crazy.
But you're also producing this as well with your...
Yeah. So Jasmine is kind of like a period TV series piece. At the same time, I'm working on this documentary called Sideman. And it's about the legacy of Steve Gilmore, who's an 83-year-old upright bass player that lives in Panama City. And he's won 3 Grammys. He's hailed as like a jazz legend hero, but not that many people know about him because... you know, he played as a side man.
Yeah.
You know, people think, and this is what really caught my interest. People think the term side man means it's a supporting actor, musician off to the side of the stage. And while that may be true, there's some real technical specifics. Like you have to earn the right to be called a side man. For example, in order to be called a side man, you have to know how to play every single song in the Great American Songbook at every key at any reasonable tempo with people that you've never met mm-hmm. without sheet music. Mm-hmm. Like that is like Jedi mm-hmm. level skill set mm-hmm. to be able to do that. And Steve is one of those people. So I thought it'd be really cool to let's do a documentary about Steve. Let's bring him up to New York.
Love it.
Let's have him meet up with some of the guys that he hasn't seen in decades. Let's rent let's book the most storied and important recording studio for jazz in New York City. It's called Sear Sound Studios. It's where John Lennon, by the way, recorded his albums after the Beatles. Mm. It's just this amazing studio. So we were up there very recently and we all cut an album together. And it was, I think it's an important album.
So how many musicians are in this gig?
Four musicians total.
So are they all sidemen or is there one lead?
They all play as sidemen.
Okay.
Steve kind of takes the reins as lead man, but okay. He's an upright bass player and that's uh-huh. traditionally a sideman role. Uh-huh. So he, you know, he kind of led the band through the recording session. This is what I want. These are the tempos. Mm-hmm. But every musician is a multi-award winning jazz player. These are literally some of the best jazz musicians in the world.
And who have they played with? I mean, they had to play with everybody. Like Ella Fitzgerald, and Anita O'Day.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Everyone from like Tony Bennett uh-huh. to Sinatra to, you know, it's just really incredible. Actually, on our website, sidemanthefilm.com lists all these amazing artists that they've played with. But they've never shared space together as a quartet.
Were they just completely overwhelmed that you had opened up a door that they were going to be able to do this? Like, how fun is that for them?
It started out as like this is cool, this will be a fun day together. And after probably the second or third song that they did, no rehearsals, all just like, okay, here's what we're gonna play, here's the tempo, here's the, you know, here's the key, and they just went at it. After the second song that we recorded, you could feel something in the room. Mm. It's the exact opposite of tension, but just as mm-hmm. dense. Mm. Like everybody, I'm getting chills even thinking mm-hmm. about it. Everybody in the room knew that what we were doing is actually incredibly important. Mm. And they just played. It was magic. Almost everything was on a single take.
Really? When's the last time Mr. Gilmour had been to New York City?
Decades.
Decades.
Yeah.
That is a treat.
I think decades, yeah.
Okay, that he was able.
We took him to Village Vanguard, which is one of the, it opened in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. It's one of the storied, it's probably one of the, people would say it's probably the best jazz club in the world. Mm-hmm. So Village Vanguard. And Steve Gilmour won his second Grammy called Live at Village Vanguard. So I brought him in there and we were able to, you know, go backstage and meet the band. Walter Smith is this amazing saxophone player that was playing that night. And everybody in the band knew who he was. That's amazing. I was like, you know, this is the guy, this is Steve Gilmour. They were like, oh, it was.
So he was royalty.
He was royalty. Mm. And to see a man who is so humble. He's just a sweet man. You'd never know that he's like a literal jazz legend. To see him get the treatment that he deserves, to be respected as a jazz legend in the eyes of these, you know, younger musicians, it was amazing.
It was a gift. You gave him like an incredible gift.
It was a really fun time.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a really good time. It was a great bonding experience.
When could we expect to see said documentary?
I believe in like getting things done while they're hot, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So I'm pushing to have this thing out. Currently, as of this taping, we're looking at like end of March. I plan on having it out by like mid to late June.
All right.
Yeah. So we're talking maybe 3 months.
And
yeah.
Will you debut here or New York City?
We'll do a private screening here.
Okay.
We'll do a few private screenings in New York. Mm-hmm. And then we'll, like, I'm really pushing for it to wind up on the national TV circuit. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we'll, you know, kind of see where it goes from there. Probably after national TV circuit, we'll probably shoot for film festivals at the end of the year and into next year. But another, you know, we're kind of working on two projects at the same time with the Sideman film. Mm-hmm. So the recording that we did at Seer Sound, mm-hmm. that was to record the original soundtrack. So we don't have to license any music. Mm-hmm. I'm like, it's a documentary about jazz musicians. Mm-hmm. Let's just get them. Let's have mm-hmm. them record the soundtrack. And then we'll film them recording the soundtrack as part of the film. Mm-hmm. So that's what we did. Mm-hmm. So at the same time that we're going through the national TV circuit, we'll also be submitting the soundtrack for a Grammy.
Okay.
So that we can give Steve one last turn mm-hmm. at bat. And here's why this is important. Here's why this is so important to me that we do this. So I mentioned Steve has 3 Grammys. He never accepted the trophies.
Oh.
Because the Academy said, if you want a trophy, here's your certificate. If you want a trophy, it costs $75.
Oh.
And he got his first one in 1977. And he said, you know, I'm a gigging musician. Mm-hmm. And it seemed kind of a little bit vain to pay money for a trophy. And so I just didn't get it. And then a few years later, he passed again. And then a few years later, he passed again. And it wasn't until just a few years ago, he said that, you know, I reached out to the Academy to see if maybe I could cash in one of my certificates and just buy a trophy at whatever the current rate is, because I want to give it to my grandkids. Mm-hmm. He was told that the Academy just doesn't do that. So that rung a bell for me that we need to do this. We need to get this filmed ASAP. And my goal is, well, if that's the Academy's policy, and I totally get it, like how many trophies, if everyone did that and had a certificate, mm-hmm. we're talking about tens of thousands of trophies that they have to produce. Mm-hmm. So I don't fault the Academy for that, mm-hmm. but I do think that Steve deserves a Grammy Award. He needs to hold a Grammy mm-hmm. trophy, and he needs to have the opportunity to give one to his grandkids. Mm-hmm. So I told him, I can't guarantee a nomination, mm-hmm. and I definitely can't guarantee a trophy, mm-hmm. but I will guarantee a swing at bat.
Mm.
So we're using the documentary mm-hmm. to really promote the soundtrack in hopes that in 2027, mm-hmm. Steve will be able to take that swing at bat.
Amazing. Such a good story.
Yeah.
Hope he wins. Sounds like he has a really good chance of it, and you as well. So go back to the TV series about... How does that have any interplay at all with Sideman?
It doesn't, but it's behind the scenes. The New York City jazz scene is all about networking. Mm-hmm. So it's helpful to have one project push the other project along.
Right.
So in my spare time, I'm, you know, writing this TV series. I plan on it being 8 episodes, and I have 4 episodes written. Mm-hmm. And then the last 4 are in Uber draft form, just outlines. But as I'm talking to people about Sideman, I'm also letting them know that I've got this.
They could be in the show too.
I've got this script that I'm working on as well, and it's more of a narrative thing. Mm-hmm. This will be the second feature length documentary that I've worked on. The first, you know, won the
Jackie
Emmy
Cochran,
nomination, the flight of Jackie Cochran. Which was last year.
Last year.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
It's an incredible team on that.
Incredible.
Yeah, it was amazing.
What a wonderful boon for so many people. I mean,
well, let's
Nancy Hastings.
Sure.
You telling the story, who was friends with Amelia Earhart, but didn't really get the same, if any, of the recognition.
It's another unsung hero story.
Unsung hero, yeah.
Yeah, it's another unsung hero story, yeah.
And you were nominated? Program.
So the film I wasn't, but the film was it got an Emmy nomination, a local Emmy nomination. Yay. Out of that, which is just really amazing.
It's amazing.
You know, so you know, I think that as I work on a project, I'm always trying to see like, okay, once that project comes close to completion, how can I leverage the accomplishments of that one mm-hmm. to move on to the next one mm-hmm. and give that next one a better chance mm-hmm. of success?
So in the mix of all of that, which is very fascinating, you've also founded a foundation for young filmmakers to under, is it the Sowell Foundation?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So Sowell Foundation is just it's the nonprofit arm of Sowell House. And we do quarterly grants to filmmakers. We actually just had them, you know, in here today filming. It's just really to give aspiring filmmakers an opportunity to practice their craft. And film is really expensive. It's a team effort job, and you've got to figure out a way to compensate or entice people to work with you and to work for you. Mm-hmm. So that's really what the grant's for, is really just to encourage more local filmmaking.
And how many are we in now? Are we in the third recipient of
filmmaking? I think we're on our sixth or seventh.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
And have you been surprised at the work that's created within that sphere?
Absolutely. Hmm. We're purposefully non-prescriptive on what type of film they should do. Mm-hmm. People fill out an application, mm-hmm. and we look through the application to see, like, you know, what their vision is. Those applications, by the way, can be found on sowellfoundation.org. And so we look through the applications once a quarter, and we choose a filmmaker, and we give them the big check when it comes time, and they have 90 days mm-hmm. They have up until the next movie screening mm-hmm. to show their film.
And that's shown here.
And we do all the screenings at Sowell House. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. So much fun.
Yeah.
Where do you see this going? And did St. Joe actually sponsor and underwrite some of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. They are such amazing supporters of what we do. So we also, you know, we do an annual comedy festival. Mm-hmm. We just completed our third annual comedy festival, Sowell Comedy
Fest.
That spans
like from here to Panama City Beach and beyond?
We did four venues all in South Walton this year. We're still trying to figure out what makes the most sense from mm-hmm. a venue standpoint. Mm-hmm. Outside of Sowell House, the other venues aren't really purpose-built for the type of live entertainment that would be like stand-up comedy,
you know?
So we did four venues, flew in comedians from all over the country, and we did over Valentine's weekend, so it's like a perfect date mm-hmm. night. Mm-hmm. Then in the fall last year, we did our first Sowell Jazz Fest, where we bring several bands together in multiple venues, and where you can listen to like a jazz tribute band, like mm-hmm. Billie Holiday, mm-hmm. Frank Sinatra, Amy Winehouse, we did last year, mm-hmm. and that was a hit. That was mm-hmm. amazing. To where people can like experience a different style of jazz mm-hmm. in a different venue every night, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday
night.
So
good. So much enrichment going on in culture in our area, which is, it's needed.
It's great. It's needed. We have such a... We're blessed to have a population of people that really want to have metropolitan style experiences. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they want to go to comedy shows. They mm-hmm. want to go to jazz shows. Mm-hmm. They want to hang out at a hip little private jazz club. You know, if that want wasn't there,
mm-hmm. it wouldn't work.
None of this would work at all.
Right.
And then we're also coupled with having, you know, just amazing sponsors. Like for the Jazz and Comedy Fest, we've got over two dozen sponsors for that, mm-hmm. including, you know, St. Joe, that's mm-hmm. our premier sponsor mm-hmm. for it. Mm-hmm. So we're just really blessed to be in a community where there's so many businesses mm-hmm. that believe in what we believe in.
Right.
You know, it's really amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing.
Yeah.
All right. So, Dave, talk about comedy. You're doing so many things, but I was never a huge fan of comedy. I don't know why. Obviously, I would like the proverbial Seinfeld show and all that, like everybody else. So obviously, I like laughing and everything, but going to a venue to hear the comedy. But in the last couple of years, I find myself more and more gravitating toward that. And I'm like asking myself, like, why? Well, what is it? And I have a theory that is, well, the world is so backward and upside down right now, like laughter is medicine for the soul. And that is actually a fact. And if it's somebody that like I really am into, like it would be a really good thing to go to. So in our little town that does have its idiosyncrasies and its culture, if you will, like, did you ever bring somebody in that bombed and you're like, oh, shoot, I'm going to have to like, you know, bring these kind of comedians in or whatever. Talk to me about that.
Yeah. Stand-up comedy is like an uncaged animal to produce. It really is. So from a venue perspective, if you take a step back and think about it, a perfect stand-up comedy venue looks exactly like a perfect jazz club. It's dark, low ceilings, you know, between 30 and 50 people, you know, having a shared experience in a really densely close proximity of each other. Right. So House just makes for a great experience, both for the audience and for the comedian. So let's talk about the comedians, right? When you think about it, stand-up comedy could be the only performance art that you can't rehearse. Mm. You have to do it on stage in front of people. Mm-hmm. Like John Mayer became amazing at guitar in his bedroom before he played in front of the first person. Mm-hmm. Stand-up comedians need to get that Malcolm Gladwellian 10,000 hours to be good. Mm-hmm. They need to do that 5 to 10 minute sets at a time. So it's not even like you can hold a stage for an hour and clock that time in. Mm. You're getting that time in like 5 to 10 minutes at a time. Mm-hmm. So I think it's probably the hardest performance art craft that you can do. It's like a tightrope every night. Mm-hmm. And there's always going to be bombs. Even you know, Seinfeld, I just saw him last year in New York, and I'll be honest, it wasn't a great set. Mm. And he even said on stage, he's like, this is one of those nights, you know, you get what you pay for. And everyone laughed because no one paid anything for the event because it was like a surprise show, right?
Best joke of the night, maybe.
Yeah. And then he was like, oh, I'm okay, he Costanzed. You know, he's like, I'm out, you know. Uh-huh. So comedians are artists. And I believe that like once, to really appreciate an artist, a creator of anything, you have to be willing as a producer to just let them run, like let them do it. So we actually don't prescribe the style of comedy that we want performers to act on. We tell them about the demographic of our area, and so that they're not, you know, they kind of know the room that they're getting into. And that's a common courtesy that all comedy club producers do. Like, this is the graphic of our, this is the demographic of our area. Mm-hmm. And then I leave it up to them, you know. So have we had some moments where there was, you know, some, you know, banter between audience and comedian? Mm-hmm. I was like, where is this going? Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of part of the ride, you know, that's part of it.
That's interesting. So you, of course, you have to let it roll. What are you going to do? Like, stop it in midstream because, you know, it's not resonating. And
exactly.
But they keep coming back and you keep getting more and more and you're growing the comedy series.
Right.
So it has to have some legs for you to keep going. And I think it's great. Very interesting. I want to come to one. Yeah. I haven't come to one before. So.
Oh, it's so much fun. Yeah.
But I will be coming to Nicole's.
Poem. Okay.
Yes,
yeah.
Like I said,
our
earlier.
First yeah, definitely. runway fashion show.
So exciting.
It's really
and
exciting.
And she's going to kick it out. I mean, I do remember some of her shows that she did years ago. And in all honesty, and I told her this, her creativity and her orchestration of her show rivaled New York Fashion Week. And when I say rivaled, I mean actually was better.
Yeah, I believe it.
A ballet going down. I don't know what she's going to do this time, but it was incredible.
I believe it. I mean, she's a real artist. She is. You know, she's in that class of, you know, super artists. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a perfect example of someone that like, you just want them to go.
Right.
You know, and just give them whatever they need in terms of support so that they just exercise their vision. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you see Sewall House in New York City?
Boy, that's a trick. That's a trap.
Didn't mean it. It would be, I think wildly successful.
I think we do something really rare that's not just, and I don't think it needs to be isolated to just South Walton. Mm-hmm. In terms of near-term expansion, I mean, we're looking at probably opening up another venue or two within the next year or so.
Okay.
And so I find that to be really exciting.
Oh, that's great. Then you are expanding.
Yeah, absolutely.
The brand.
I think we'll probably do local in the near future, and then we'll probably branch out a little bit more in the, 5 years and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important for me to prove to myself that this isn't a one-hit wonder type of business, that it's something that's replicatable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like art's a tough thing and I consider us artists, artists and producers. Art's a tough thing to replicate and then to be, you put one Sewall House up against another Sewall House. Mm-hmm. And now there's this comparison of the two.
Mm-hmm.
Which one's better? Which one do people like more? It's going to be really tough, I think, to open another Sewall House and for it to have the level of fidelity of this one that's really important to me and have people hopefully like it just the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
But besides everything that it is to the obvious eye, an art show, a comedy club, a private club, a fashion show, and all of that, which is all amazing and it's all artistic. Do you know what really is at the baseline of it? It's making people get off their couch and come here and then gather and talk to people, because COVID kind of ushered in the, I don't really want to be around people. I don't want to leave my house. Like maybe a laziness that crept in, or just like a lack of the general pop wanting to be together. So what you really did was break through the glass ceiling of creating something good enough for people to actually come here.
Oh, thanks.
I mean, because few people, wanted to partake and get to know people and talk to them. So I think that is maybe one of your biggest hits that you were able to do that.
Well, I think that
they're always smiling, all the pictures of the people that are here. They're not just okay, I'm at a show. They're in it to win it, They want to be here and they're very happy.
Yeah.
And that's really successful.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I think that having a special shared experience in a room full of people is magical. Mm-hmm. I don't think that there's anything quite like that. And we as a human species, we're meant to share experiences together, back from the caveman days, right? We travel gathering, in cliques and tribes and stuff, I think that what we do aligns with cultural infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's only a few businesses down here that really put that on the front burner of what they consider important. I think Cultural Arts Alliance is a prime example of a that's a business and a nonprofit that looks at and places a very high value on cultural infrastructure. Mm-hmm. It's literally in their name.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, it's part of our ecotourism, cultural tourism is also part of the mandate as well.
Right, right. The thing with cultural infrastructure is it looks horrible on a balance sheet.
Mm-hmm.
So, every town needs roads and police and schools and hospitals and red lights. Mm-hmm. That's like core infrastructure stuff. But if you don't have that cultural infrastructure, then it feels empty and a void, right? Mm-hmm. Almost feels like a 100% tourist town is what that would look like, right?
Right.
And I think that we have enough locals now that have expectations that we're not just a sleepy little tourist town. Right. Like we actually have a pretty hip vibe locally. Right. It just so happens that, you know, tourists can come here too. And, you right. know, we treat them really well as well. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. But cultural infrastructure, I think, is really important. It just doesn't fit well on a balance sheet, mm-hmm. which is why it's so often overlooked. Mm-hmm. Robert and Daryl Davis creating Seaside, they created probably the areas, one of the areas, like, that's Seaside's a core piece of cultural infrastructure.
Yeah, the first landmark that set the stage right. for pretty much everything that we're doing. And you and I have a heart for it because we're both board members of the Seaside Institute. And know full well, you know, as you really immerse yourself into their world and listen to the conversations that are being had, like how incredible that vision that they created 40 years ago set the stage for you and I to sit here and have a business.
Absolutely.
That will never leave my consciousness about mm-hmm. what they did.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the obvious choice, the next logical step for the Davises would have been to put up high-rise condos on the beach, turn the north side of 30A into a parking lot, and have a nice day and make mm-hmm. buckets of money and have a nice day, mm-hmm. right? The approach that they took was so, like, extraordinary. And they just said, this is a business that we're going to create. Mm-hmm. where we're going to lean in really hard on cultural infrastructure, and we have a really long tail before we have to experience success, mm-hmm. right? Like, we don't have to experience success for years and years and years, but we'll know it when it's finally
right.
here.
Right. Well, I mean, they had a vision that they never took their hand off the plow to get out. They want, and they're still part of the master plan that Robert has that he wants to finish. And I find that so commendable. He recently gave me a book I should read. One of his friends wrote, New York Times bestseller. It's called Grit. And I'm going to, like, pass it on to you after I finish
Wonderful.
Reading it. But it's so apropos to what we're talking about right now for them, for you, I would say even for me, that you don't have to be the smartest person in the world to become and finish something and be successful. You have to have perseverance and a grit that most people do not have. And in my own life, I can definitely say, you know, sign me up, because that's, like, my biggest claim to fame is that I'm not going to give up. Right. There's a lot of things I don't have, but I do have perseverance.
Right.
And you do too. But sometimes that's the only way you're going to get it.
That's right.
And very few people don't want to wait the amount of time that it can take, and it can take forever.
Yeah.
In your case, it didn't take forever. In my case, I feel like it took, like, an insane amount of time.
Well, I mean, that's it just gets back to delayed gratification. Like, you know, I think that there's a direct correlation, like, how long you can hold out before receiving that dopamine hit,
yeah.
that good job, I did mm-hmm. a good job mm-hmm. dopamine hit. Mm-hmm. Like, however your reward mechanism works for that dopamine effect to happen, you know, I tell people all the time, just, like, don't experience that yet. Hold off as long as you mm-hmm. can before you start to experience that.
Yeah. I mean, even if you did get that sooner than later, like, you're still not going to summit, in my opinion, until you understand that what you're doing is either a mission field or what you were created to do, or something that you really, really want to see to the end, and the dopamines don't matter because you want to see it to the vision to the end. And you don't really view that for a long time as a money hit, because sometimes it isn't a money hit. Sometimes it's a money dump.
Right.
And that's really painful.
Right.
But if you do not quit, you have a very good chance of making it.
Oh, yeah. Just lean into it. And don't stop. And don't stop. And then, you know, if from a money perspective, I always, you know, tell a lot of friends of mine are entrepreneurs. We live in a very entrepreneurial community. I tell them, like, your consistent paychecks is, I look at it almost like a poison.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you want to avoid paying yourself mm-hmm. as long as humanly possible just take whatever mm-hmm. you were going to pay yourself with mm-hmm. and then reinvest it back into the business mm-hmm. and just make sure that the business mm-hmm. keeps evolving mm-hmm. right. and stays stable. Yeah. Right?
I have a joke for that in yeah. my household, and it's called feed the beast.
That's right.
Yeah. Let's keep putting Let's the coins
keep
in the
feeding the, yeah. feeding the beast. The beast.
Yes. Yeah. That must be fed.
Yeah. The beast must be fed. I mean, yeah. for Soul House, I haven't, you know, we're 5 years old. I haven't taken a paycheck yet. So
you're feeding the beast.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about. Yeah.
Your TV show, not if, but when it happens, will that take you to Hollywood? Like, where do you see that going?
I don't know. Like, I'm really interested in this video production effort. And now I've got enough staff at Soul House to kind of keep the beast running, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. To where now I can start to divert some of my time. I believe in, you know, I work like 80-ish mm-hmm. hours a week, mm-hmm. and I absolutely love every minute mm-hmm. of most of it. Mm-hmm. So I'll be diverting a lot more of my time into video and music production.
Yeah. So exciting.
Yeah, it's just really exciting. Yeah.
And can I tell you, you have really good hair to walk this next journey that you're going to walk. Thanks. I think it looks great. Keep rocking this on your next iteration into the world that you're heading toward. It suits you very well, and it looks good.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Well, yeah. Dave, thanks for doing a second podcast with us and in your space this time, which is beautiful, and I appreciate you letting us be here and sharing your story with us. I can't wait to see where this continued journey is going to go, but it's very exciting. And my heartfelt congratulations to you and all that you've done and all that you've done for the community in a very, very short period of time. It's very appreciated and it's very impressive.
Well, thank you so much. I'm just mm-hmm. so glad and grateful that we just get to share space together, man.
Yes, totally.
It's really great.
Totally.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. All right, everybody. We're in season 6 of V-Speaks Conversations with Heart and Soul. And man, this was a good conversation. And I appreciate Dave so much. And I hope you learned a lot. And if you haven't checked out Soul House, please do. Thanks, everyone. Have a good day. Bye.